everybody, and welcome back to Thank Godzilla. It's Friday 2000. It's Friday, and that means it's Godzilla 2000. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. I write for The Wrap. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a critic 2000.
2000.
I write for Slash Film 2000. Yes. Because it's the turn of the millennium. And there was 2000 fever, damn it.
Everyone wanted to get in on the 2000 action, which to be fair, nice round number. How can you resist? This is our podcast where we're reviewing every single Godzilla movie ever and every single Godzilla adjacent movie ever. But we're past that for now. We're back into Godzilla land, and we're about to start the Millennium Era with a film titled, fittingly enough, Godzilla 2000, Millennium, which is a little redundant, but when this movie was coming out, 1999, a little jump in the gun on the 2000 bit.
In the United States, it came out in 2000.
To be fair. A lot of movies, a lot of filmmakers, a lot of publicity, they were trying to really capitalize on calling things 2000. And to be fair, they had for a while. There was Death Race 2000 back in the 70s. The idea of just things being 2000-y was really, really cool. Yeah. Dracula 2000 was a thing.
Not a good movie.
Not a good movie. The Blues Brothers hit 2000.
Blues Brothers 2000.
Also not a good movie.
Haven't seen the Blues Brothers 2000. Hmm. There was a Pokemon the movie 2000.
That's true.
Several others as well.
I'm blanking now, but there were a lot. And I just want to see, where is that monster team up?
Of all of the 2000 movies?
I want to see Godzilla 2000, Dracula 2000, and the Blues Brothers 2000 in a Death Race 2000. Like, just wacky racers, but it's Godzilla in giant car.
The Blues Brothers are winning that one, but...
That's probably true. You're not wrong about that. But
Millennium Fever struck. I feel like 1999 was a notoriously good year for American cinema.
And international as well, honestly. If you look at the list of movies that came out in 1999, it's a staggeringly good year.
And I feel like the movies that came out in the year 2000 really sucked. Like, there weren't a lot of great films that came out in the year 2000. And I feel like
we kind of blew it a little early.
Kind of like collapsed over the finish lines. Yeah. Like, we made it to the end of the millennium. Oh, wait, we have to keep going.
Surely we could have saved, The Insider and 10 Things I Hate About You and The Matrix for 2000. Could we have just... Hung out a little longer.
The Matrix makes sense in the year 2000. New beginnings, all technological nonsense. There was the whole Y2K fear, and I feel like it felt like the end of history if you were there in 1999.
It felt like a chapter was being turned in the whole planet's book.
And I think the world felt a good helping of millennial angst. It's like, we don't really know where to go from here.
And some people thought we weren't going to go anywhere. Remember the doomsayers? There were people who said the world would end.
Literally going to end on New Year's Eve, 1999.
Did you, on New Year's Eve, 1999, did you have one brief second where you're like, what if they're right? What if this is it?
I kind of hoped that Y2K would strike.
Yeah.
And there would be like chaos in the streets. And I went over to a friend's house and we watched from his balcony. It's like... Somebody did set a couch on fire, but that's just because they were being rowdy. It was this was in Westwood, so it was near UCLA. It's college town.
That's kind of typical New Year's rowdiness.
Yeah,
ill-advised. I wouldn't recommend it.
But... And it was like out in the middle of the street, so like it wasn't near anything, but cars had to go around it. Kind of neat to see a couch burn in the middle of the street.
Don't see that every day.
A little bit of an Escape from New York vibe.
Yeah. But it turned out fine. They worked out all the kinks. They fixed the problems.
I feel like entertainment throughout the early 2000s started to deteriorate a little bit. A lot of the irony that we suffused in the 90s fell away into actual offensive shit. Especially if you look at the comedies that were made in America in the early 2000s. It was a bad wave. A lot of bad trends were going on. If you were like I and my friends into like heavy metal and grunge rock and sort of like the rock scene, you just felt so much pain watching bands like Stained and Puddle of Mud and all of these this wave of new metal come in and it's all sludgy and awful.
We had Chad Kroeger.
Yeah. Okay, your point.
Oh, just thought you should know.
All right.
That wasn't a counter-argument.
Okay, yes, I agree with that.
A hero will save us, but I'm not going to stand here and wait.
And into all of this mess came Godzilla 2000, where I remember watching this in the theater. This was the first Japanese Godzilla film I saw in a theater.
Mm-hmm. Actually, there only have been in wide release. Mm-hmm. There's only been a few lately. Yeah. Like it's been a long
Godzilla
time.
Godzilla Minus One is one of the widest released ones.
Yeah, even Shin Godzilla was a limited release.
Yeah, and I remember, and I'd seen some Godzilla films before this, not just the Roland Emmerich, and I remember thinking that this one was so angsty and dark compared to the films I had seen before. Maybe I'd just come off of Destroy All Monsters or something.
Yeah, maybe you're watching some of the older ones.
I'm rewatching it this time, and this is the goofiest shit.
This is really ridiculous. Yeah,
this is it's got a flying saucer that they pull up from the ocean floor, uh-huh. and it sucks up Godzilla DNA, and there's this other gigantic monster. It's called Orga, and it is.
It's a pretty
just as silly as the other Godzilla movies. The only difference, the thing that maybe made me think that it was slightly angstier, was that Godzilla has angry eyes now.
He's pissed off looking Godzilla.
He's hunched over now, is kind of a scowl on his face. They redesigned Godzilla for the new Millennium Era.
For the first time in a live action movie, Godzilla was green. Mm. He's always been kind of a really dark grayish green at best.
Black. Yeah.
But he's generally speaking, he's been more of a really dark gray. Yeah, now he's a proper green. In fact, for a minute, I was entertaining the notion that, despite my protests, Godzilla Jr. Actually had graduated to proper Godzilla status.
So that was supposed to be Godzilla Jr.
Well, I thought that, and that would have made a lot of sense. There's really not a lot in the movie that directly contradicts that. But apparently the official, Toho canon is no. This is a totally separate Godzilla, and we're going to see a lot of that in the Millennium Era. A lot of these movies aren't directly connected. They're just different takes on Godzilla, it makes sense, but it's also kind of weird to just go that willy-nilly about it.
The way I see it, and I've seen all of the Millennium films before, and they're all of a piece except for one, which definitely isn't.
Mm.
I think the rest kind of follow a continuity. It's not going to be as strong as in the Heisei era, because we had Mickey.
Yeah.
We had a common character in all of those movies to kind of bind them all together. She was never a major player. Occasionally she had some plot points.
Mm-hmm.
But her presence there was a reminder that these things are connected and Godzilla is continuing to change. And by the time we got to Godzilla versus Destoroyah, I was here's what happens at the end of all of these monster fights. He just sort of starts to heat up and burn out after a while. The millennial era is not going to have quite that strong a continuity, but it's okay to pretend that they do, that they connect in one way.
They're kind of loosey-goosey.
But there is one where Godzilla actually was redesigned, looks a lot different, has silver eyes, stands a little bit more upright than the millennial, because the Millennium Godzilla now leans forward a little bit, is a little bit more lizardish.
He's got more of an alligator snout, much more, really just big old rows of sharp teeth. He really does look more like a lizard than the weird lizard mutant hybrid that we've had before. I have a question for you, because the American version of Godzilla 2000 is a bit different, apparently, from the Japanese version, and I was only able to, in the time that I had allotted, track down the American version. Which version or versions have you seen?
I've only seen the American version.
Okay, so the American version, when they brought it over here, they made some changes. Nothing, gigantically different, but it's not like whole plot points have been, changed or dropped. But it's 9 minutes shorter. Apparently, mostly it's just business stuff that they felt that they could trim. They also, I think there are two significant things. For whatever reason, Sony decided to re-record some of Godzilla's roars to use the Roland Emmerich Godzilla roars. So if they sound familiar, that's why.
Well, but they also use the old Godzilla screonk noise here
as
and
well,
there, and
but they managed to inject the American version in there a little bit. But the other thing, and this is probably the bigger deal, apparently tonally, the American version was made goofier. There were a lot more sort of, whenever we cut to the general citizens, people will never see for more than one scene, and they're going about their business, and then they see Godzilla out the window, they go, holy crap! Great Caesar's ghost! I think they actually say out loud. That was more of the American version trying to be take the piss out of it a little bit. So maybe the original version like is that, a little harder.
Kind
of
tell, but
yeah. But I'm saying maybe the original Japanese version, you know,
I know
reads a little less silly.
I know this is another soft reboot. That this isn't another direct sequel to the 1954 film.
Yeah,
and it ignores all of the continuities that have come since.
Yeah,
which is weird because I don't know how much. Like, it's first showed up in 1954, and they took care of it, but this is the year 2000, and they're still, like, really on their toes about Godzilla.
Yeah, it's really weird. This movie does not reintroduce Godzilla, or even the status quo of Godzilla.
No, in fact, Godzilla just shows up.
It's
right away in this movie.
Just throw you in the deep end. It's like you missed issue one of Godzilla 2000, the comic book, and you're just jumping. I honestly thought I missed the first act somehow. Like, because Godzilla is just a force of nature. He's like a hurricane or something, like something, some kind of seasonal event that you always have to be ready for. Oh, it's tornado season again. Oh, it's Godzilla season again. Godzilla will just occasionally show up, blow up a power station. Apparently, they don't really do a lot with this, but they say Godzilla is attracted to power stations, whether it's electrical or nuclear. And
wants to destroy
it. He's like, oh, that fucking power station. They built another one. Crush, 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 crush. Leave it alone. And then he just goes back into the ocean, looking over his shoulder. I mean it this time.
Well, and had they established that, even in just like a line of dialogue, he's back again this year.
Yeah.
Or like, this is the 15th time. You know, something along those lines.
Well, what we do get introduced to is a group called the Godzilla Mobile Detection Unit.
Yeah, which is, like, they're like storm chasers.
Yeah. This very much feels like the vibe that they were going for a lot of this movie was the movie Twister. which, honestly, fine. Twister is kind of a weird movie in that there's not a lot to it, really. But it's got good vibes.
It was an effects bonanza. It was a good tone. But
it wasn't particularly well like admired by critics when it came out, but audiences liked it fine. And nowadays you look back at it and you go, that was a summer blockbuster where the biggest plot point was, will a guy get his wife to sign their divorce papers? Everything else is just, there's a tornado, and then we're going to go driving after it, and then it stops. And then we find another one. That's it. Before Twister came out, everyone I knew, I was like, I can't remember how old I was when it came out. But
96 that came out.
Yeah. It was like last year of like junior high or something for me. So like, everyone I know was like interested because Jan de Bont had done Speed and the trailer looked really cool. But we were like, how do you make a movie out of that? Is there like some bad guy making twisters that we have to stop? Like, what's the plot? There is none. It's His Girl Friday, but with twisters instead of journalists. That's the whole movie.
Yeah.
I'm curious what the 1930s screwball comedy, the new Twisters movie, the upcoming sequel, is going to be. Is it bringing up Baby, where it's like, oh no, we have to take care of this twister.
You have to hide the twister in the closet when the boss comes over.
Oh no. But the idea of just a whole bunch of people, and they're just working class stiffs who are very interested. They know their science, but they just get in their vans and they chase after Godzilla to try to like get readings or there's a reporter who's like hanging out with this one Godzilla chaser and his daughter.
Well, they have these little sensors they want to send up in a twister, but they have to like drive directly underneath it to make that happen.
Right. That's pretty thin. But that was Twister, by the way. They're not trying to do that to Godzilla. They're not trying to, like, send up a sensor into Godzilla. Good luck. it's a rough day for everybody. So we're introduced to our hero. He's a workaday scientist. He used to be, like, a big college professor type. But he left the scientific community, or the serious scientific community. And now he's part of this very it's not really fringe, because they're right. There's no conspiracy involved. Mm-hmm. But they're just people who are just doing this in their spare time. He's working with his daughter, and his daughter is a little hustler, and I love her, because, like, when the reporter is like, okay, can you drive me around and take me to see Godzilla so I can get pictures? And she's like, how much? You're gonna pay to join the Godzilla Club? You have to pay to join? Yes, we have membership dues. Pay up. Like, she's very stern.
Sorry.
It's okay. So we're introduced to, they're just looking for Godzilla, and in the opening sequence, hey, there's Godzilla. Mm-hmm. Just right showing up. And I like...
And they're, you know, it's not just boom, he's there. Like, there's pan up of Godzilla's body. Kind of a slow reveal, but yeah, Godzilla's right there at the beginning.
It's a little easy, because they say, like, we're going to, like, shoot this thing into the ground, and it's a seismometer, and if we detect a certain kind of vibration, it means Godzilla shows up. 2 seconds later, oh, it's Godzilla showing up. Well, that was convenient. How did we know? And Godzilla is going to, like, trudge towards a power station and blow it up. But I actually really love this sequence. This is one of my favorite Godzilla attack sequences. Just because of how it's filmed, there's a lot of impressive scale by placing people, human beings, a lot closer to Godzilla than usual.
Yeah.
And my favorite bit is when they're chasing Godzilla in their car and they drive through a tunnel. And when they get on the outside, and they get to the end of the tunnel, Godzilla's standing right there looking at him. Like, it looks like the coolest amusement park ride. Like, you're sitting there in the car, Godzilla, like, roars at them. He doesn't breathe atomic breath or anything, but he roars at them and it fogs up the glass, which is so tactile. I love that. And then they're like, we should back up. And so they're backing up and Godzilla's destroying the tunnel behind them. And I'm like, that whole sequence is fucking cool. I had a good time with that part.
Okay.
Yeah, that was like really fun Godzilla stuff.
All right.
Yeah.
I didn't have fun with this movie.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not exactly sure why. There's something off about Godzilla 2000.
It is a weird film, and I'm not a huge fan either, but there are definitely parts I glommed onto.
Like, they're not really rolling with the silliness. Mm-hmm. The thrills look really fake. I think a big part of it is the way, like... We talked about this when we got to the Heisei era, how comparing Godzilla versus... or Terror of Mechagodzilla, which came out in 75, with Godzilla... The Return of Godzilla, which came out in 1984,
yeah,
and how dramatically film had evolved in that span,
yeah,
just in terms of photography and lighting and just camera movements.
Very different aesthetic.
Really, really different, and how I credited it to sort of the rise of certain kinds of American adventure films, you know, the rise of Spielberg, that kind of thing, Star Wars. How films started to look a little bit more slick, and photography started to change an awful lot. And I feel like something similar has happened here, where you go to Godzilla vs. Destoro, which was made in 95, and how it looked like a 90s film. It looked a little bit broad and silly. Even those Rebirth of Mothra films have a kind of...
sort of lo-fi home video aesthetic.
You could see things start to fall apart. Remember in Rebirth of Mothra 2, where Mothra turns into, like, a bunch of little robots, which was a little odd, just sort of magically turns into these machine-like
creatures. I don't even know if that's the weirdest thing I've seen in any of these movies.
Well, I mean,
movies,
it's not that it's weird, it's that it looked bad.
It looked, because here's the thing, when they were using the older techniques, they were techniques that they had kind of perfected, to whatever extent that you can, using the limitations of, you know, suit-mation. But when they started using, and we're going to say that a lot in Godzilla 2000, when they started using more computer-generated imagery, it is at the birth of that medium, and people were still figuring out how to make it work. The technology was still evolving. And now things that would look pretty awesome today, pretty believable, they look kind of like shit in Godzilla 2000. Yeah. There's some compositing in this. There's a lot of compositing in this movie that is embarrassing.
So yeah, there's a lot of really bad compositing. There's a lot of bad CGI, and... for some reason, filmmakers decided to make photography just look really murky. And maybe it's just the visuals that are keeping me from feeling the lightness and silliness of the movie. Visually, it's communicating to me that this is a hefty story.
Yeah.
but it isn't. It's about an orca and this this thing that they fish up out of the ocean and start sucking up Godzilla DNA and growing Godzilla fins.
For me, the thing that definitely the visual effects are holding it back. Even the Godzilla suit, which I like the design, but he's got a really obvious kind of like seam on his mouth. Like it looks really, it looks more like a like an action figure toy, like a flappy mouth kind of thing. Which again, not the end of the world, but the more you focus on it, the more distracting it is.
In Return of Godzilla, they had like an articulated mouth on Godzilla, like a sneer occasionally. This one, it's back to that old Showa era, where the jaw just sort of flaps open and shut occasionally.
Yeah, not my favorite look, but for me, it comes down to the storytelling, because you're dropping us into this world where Godzilla is a fact of life, and that's fine, but I still need to, like, excuse me, meet the characters and have them, like, introduce the concepts. Like, we just came off of a whole era where the overarching, like, excuse me, the overarching element was that Godzilla keeps attacking, and we have come up with a whole government organization, highly funded, very ambitious, very technologically forward, group of experts who were designed specifically to keep an eye on Godzilla. In Godzilla 2000, same basic setup, Godzilla keeps attacking, but it's storm chasers and two guys. There's two government agents, one who's like very serious and looks cool in a trench coat, and one scientist guy who's a little bit more nervy. Excuse me. Sorry. And they're like, they're not evil, but they're like a little unfeeling. They don't, they talk about things like, you know, oh, well, if we try to like destroy Godzilla with these underwater mines, we think that'll destroy Godzilla. And when someone points out, isn't this like in like a populated area? Wouldn't there be collateral damage? And everyone's like, we think we could keep it to 200-300 tops.
Yeah.
Well, which is like, that's not great. Sure, well, that isn't the goal.
Did you watch the American version?
I did.
excuse me. The way they deliver that line, I can guarantee there's only going to be 2 to 3 million people dead, tops.
100.
Or,
yeah.
They're imitating George C. Scott from Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah.
Like, they're quoting the movie, which is, and I think they even, like, respond to him with another line from Dr. Strangelove, which is a little weird, because it's not, characters aren't quoting Dr. Strangelove, like, the screenwriters are.
Well, that was the kind of thing people used to do a lot, I think in the 90s that was pretty common, where you just sort of harken back and do, like, an entire bit. Like, Quentin Tarantino would take, like, whole lines and exchanges from his movies. There's like bits in Jackie Brown that are just straight out of Stanley Kubrick's The Killing. Just a couple of lines of dialogue in a row, you know? Which is, again, no one's accusing him of anything. He's always been very upfront about that. But like,
yeah, well, you're talking about Quentin Tarantino.
I'm just saying that was getting popularized at the time, the idea of doing those kinds of more subtle callbacks. But again, though, that's probably, I'd be surprised if anyone knows this, let me know, but like, I'd be surprised if in the Japanese version it was that overt a callback to Dr. Strangelove, if it was like quoting it. Maybe it was. But that also, considering we know that they took some liberties with the American dub, that might have just been someone being cute.
Yeah.
Again, we saw the version we were able to see, and we're sorry about that. There's a cute bit here where we follow. That's the other thing about this movie. There really isn't like a clear protagonist. We're just kind of like jumping around to everybody, and no one really has much of a story or even much of a character, really, which I think also prevents it from feeling very focused. But the reporter, she's at her office, and she turns in her photos of Godzilla, and they should be good. She was right up in his face. And then it turns out Godzilla's atomic radiation breath erases photographs. Which is, okay, that's an interesting little bit there.
Magnetic, I guess, in some way. They don't say that. But
I guess. I feel like if it's close, if his breath is so toxic it's irradiating your photographs, you should go to a doctor. Because you were right there. I feel like you should get checked out. What kind of anti-Godzilla meds we have in this timeline, but anyway, So yeah. I'm looking over my okay, so the main villain plot starts out kind of weird. It's really incidental. Godzilla is attacking, and oh, by the way, we found a giant meteorite at the bottom of the ocean.
Ooh.
And we are bringing it up to the surface because when we started scanning it with our submarine, there was like an energy source inside. And we think this might be some sort of important scientific discovery, a new energy source could fuel the whole world. Wouldn't that be great? Godzilla keeps blowing up all our other energy things. Let's let's get a new one. They bring it up to the surface, and it's this big fucking rock. But it starts acting weird. It, like, it floats, which it shouldn't because it's a giant fucking rock. But also it starts, like, leaning over on, like, its tippy toe, like one of the shards in Arrival, which also shouldn't be happening. The rock part of it starts sliding off until it's like a metallic...
It's like a smooth thing.
Yeah. Man. It's not quite like a flying saucer. It looks a bit like the ship in Flight of the Navigator.
Yeah.
You know?
It's just a smooth... looks like a skipping stone.
Yeah.
It looks like the Bean in Philadelphia. A little bit.
The so... Our main Godzilla government guys are concerned about this and killing Godzilla at the same time. They're trying to kill Godzilla all over the place, and they're shooting rockets at him. Very unconvincing rockets. Nothing is working. Our main scientist has discovered that by picking up one of Godzilla's scales and working with the government, that there is something in Godzilla's genes that makes Godzilla indestructible. And there's a whole bit where they say, okay, you should get to name it.
Oh, yeah, and he calls it G1.
He calls it like G1. Was it G1 Generator? Regenerator G1. And I'm like, you could have named it after your daughter. You could have named it something poetic. Yeah. You could have named it, you know, anything cool. You picked, like, the most boring name possible. But,
I was very fond of the end of the movie Titan AE.
Oh, yeah.
Create a brand new planet. Like, yeah. That was the whole idea. Earth had been destroyed, and they wanted to create a new planet for humans to live on.
Yeah.
And they do at the end. They succeed. And they land, and the guy who did it, main character, is like, you get to name this new planet. It's going to be, how about Earth Mark II? It's like, no, this is Bob. What? No, you can't name a planet Bob. No, nobody says you have to live on Bob. Planet's just named Bob.
That is a good bit. That's all going on. But they're trying to destroy Godzilla while this UFO thing is coming out. And it's not going well. Godzilla isn't very destroyable. And then the UFO decides, all right, let's fucking do this. And it flies out of the ocean. Well, it's
like looking for something. I got the impression that it was looking for some sort of power source.
Yeah. Yeah. There's canon apparently about this thing that is not clear in the movie at all. Again, maybe this is a translation thing. Maybe there's more exposition in the Japanese version. But they're studying this thing and they realize that it is powered by light. So this when this spaceship... Thank you, Luca. Luke, okay, he's trying to punch me in the face now. Luke, sweetie, trying to podcast about Godzilla. He's my cat, if you're new.
Luca's just some person in the room with us.
Right?
He's trying to punch you in the face.
Hey, Luca, knock it off. Their theory is that the spaceship crash landed on Earth 60 million years ago.
Yeah.
And it landed so far into the ocean that because it was like solar powered or light powered, no light could reach it. So... It just kind of went into hibernation mode. And now, 60 million years later, a submarine shined a light on it, and that kicked it in just a little. Mm. And as they raised it up from the ocean surface, it started getting more and more powerful, until now it's getting back up to speed. And now, it's scanning things, which is probably not great, and it starts flying around, and as they're trying to destroy Godzilla, this UFO flies up to Godzilla and shoots him.
Yeah.
Just all of a sudden, not provoked, Godzilla didn't do nothing to this guy. Just shoots Godzilla, and Godzilla just flies out into the ocean. And everyone's like, what the fuck? That's probably not good.
Godzilla gets up. Who is that fucker? Okay, this is going down.
Godzilla gets his ass kicked proper at the beginning. And honestly, for a while, the plot is about this UFO.
Yeah.
Like, for a long time. Godzilla takes a back seat for, like, the second half of the movie for a lot of it. And it's just, what's the UFO doing? Well, the UFO is flying, like, over, like, a big city, and it's hovering over a really big skyscraper. And that's when I realized, this is Godzilla versus ID4. The image of a flying saucer hovering over a landmark and destroying it. They're doing that again, but...
It's weird because Roland Emmerich just wrecked Godzilla in Toho's eyes.
Right.
Trying to get away from that director, and now they're kind of emulating a style.
But it's the villain, though. They're getting vengeance on Roland Emmerich. Godzilla, we're going to ruin Roland Emmerich.
Godzilla's going to destroy Roland Emmerich, and... They'll do that again in Godzilla Final Wars a little bit more explicitly. Godzilla, we have to remind ourselves, was not free from pop culture influences. We've said before, a film I actually really love, Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah from the Heisei era, was directly influenced by the success of Back to the Future Part 2.
Yeah, and Terminator as well. They went very time travel with it, yeah.
But I actually found the story where the producer of, one of the Toho producers, went to a theater when Godzilla was playing, and found that the theater showing Back to the Future Part 2 was far more crowded.
Luca, stop knocking.
And that was a concept he just couldn't understand. Why are people seeing this time travel? Well, you know what? Let's do a time travel movie.
People like time travel.
And everybody said, that's wild. You can't do time travel in a Godzilla movie. Mm-hmm. You know, we can only go so far with this.
Right.
And they said, no, we'll do it. We're going to do time travel.
And
they went
very far. Mm. And even in, like, the Showa era, you know, the success of the Gamera movie started making the Godzilla movies more kid-friendly.
Yeah.
For example. And then we would see things like the Mothra movie the Godzilla versus Mothra movie had, like, this whole, like, Disney element where they felt like they were inspired by the creation of Disneyland and wanted to use that as a plot point.
Right.
You know?
It was Godzilla versus Gigan, right?
No. It was earlier than that, because it was the one with the big Mothra egg.
Oh, yeah. They're trying to sell tickets to see the Mothra egg.
Yeah. Luca, he's swatting at me. Luca, did I...
Just wants attention, I think.
You just want cuddles?
Yeah.
Okay, give him some cuddles.
Speaking of monsters.
Anyway. So, yeah, Godzilla gets his ass kicked, and this UFO...
There's a lot of time being spent with this UFO. It's flying around doing stuff.
It's flying around. It's on top of a city, and they use, like, infrared to see that it's, like, putting its tendrils in the internet, and we can see it absorbing the internet.
Sucking up internet. Yeah, information.
I
like that shot of the UFO, like, reaching its tendrils into a high-rise to, like, to suck energy out of it.
Yeah.
Looks really cool. Looks like something out of Mars Attacks, you know? There's something kind of kitschy about it.
We realize now that probably isn't how that would look, sucking information out of things. But who cares? It looks cool.
I'm sorry. We don't really know what a UFO sucking up information would look like.
Yes. I think we have a general sense of it now.
A Martian would never say that.
They'd have Wi-Fi. Come on.
I suppose so.
We're just looking at Wi-Fi is what we're looking at. What does Wi-Fi look like? Tentacles.
What we learned from Independence Day is that you can have an Apple laptop and hack into an alien computer mainframe with it.
There was an explanation for that. You know that, right?
Something about Steve Jobs was kidnapped
and brought
to an alien world.
The gag is that... Luca, jeez, you are so needy today, you little cute guy. No, the idea was that in Independence Day that, you know, the alien spacecraft landed in Roswell. And that a lot of the technological advances of the 20th century were reverse engineered from it.
Oh, that's right.
So a MacBook was actually reverse engineered from the alien in the first place. It's compatible, which is thin, but at least it's an explanation.
Yeah.
You know? So there's that. But, I had a point, and then Luca was cute. We should do this as a video podcast.
Just so you can see this.
Just for the cat.
Adorable kitty.
Adorable cat just wants attention. You love your buddy.
So yeah, UFO.
And it's doing
the UFO is also, like, it's able to extrapolate DNA.
It's scanning DNA. The story of the UFO, according to the research I've done online, and this is not articulated in the movie, The aliens in the spacecraft, the Millennians.
Uh-huh.
Just go with it. When they landed on Earth, in order to preserve themselves and go into hibernation, they kind of gave up their corporeal form and became just kind of this weird mass.
All right.
And they are trying to find... But
this is not in the movie,
no, it's not. But this is according to my research on the internet. I don't know how canonical it is, but this is allegedly the story. The idea is they are trying to scan things like life forms on Earth, find out more information on Earth, to find out how to live on this planet. And what they discover is that because Godzilla has that regeneration DNA, Godzilla is the perfect thing to emulate. So when it scans Godzilla, it wants to copy Godzilla.
Okay.
And that's why when Godzilla shows up again, it starts transforming into Godzilla. Or rather, it ejects a big kind of like tripod type classic alien monster.
From War of the Worlds, yeah.
Yeah, and then gradually turns more and more Godzilla-ish.
Yeah, it grows like limbs and a head after a while.
The head apparently intentionally looks like the Roland Emmerich Godzilla head a little bit. As if, like, if you were trying to copy Godzilla and not doing a very good job, you'd end up with the Roland Emmerich Godzilla.
Oh, okay, I get that, yeah.
Yeah.
Some alien creature or culture is trying to copy Godzilla and not doing a very good job of it.
Yeah. Cute, right? But there's all of this crap going on where, like, there's more intrigue with, like, the hero scientist and the evil scientist. These evil kids are wearing the trench coat. None of that really tracks or makes a big difference. There's a whole thing where the alien spacecraft, for whatever reason, decides to land on the newspaper office building where the reporter works. And everyone gets pulled away from it. But she finds out that because something keeps hacking my laptop... Oh, it's the aliens. I have to run inside the building and disconnect the computers to stop the aliens from learning too much. Because eventually they're going to suck up all the information and there'll be no information left, is the general vibe that we're getting.
Oh.
So she's stuck in the building. Our scientist and his daughter run up to save her. But now, the bad guys, and actually a fun reversal, the evil or corrupt government types, they've decided to, in order to destroy this UFO, we're going to put a giant bomb or weapon on the top floor of the building. So, you know, on Independence Day, when the UFOs attack the buildings, they shoot an energy beam down and destroy them. This is going to shoot an energy beam up into the UFO. Yeah. Just the exact opposite. What if the Empire State Building destroyed the UFO and not the other way around? Which is a fun idea. But there's a countdown for it. And the scientist, the hero scientist, says, "You go without me. Get my daughter away from here. I'll try to get out if I can, but someone has to stop them from hacking these computers." Pretty thin. She runs away. She tries to tell all, like, the government guys, "Hey, he's in there. Give him more time." And they're like, "Nope." And then she's like, "Okay." And they all leave because there's going to detonate the building and they could all die. And she starts leaving too. And she says, "No, I got to do the right thing. I have to take this 8-year-old back into that building that's going to blow up." So she turns around. Why not at least try to leave her there? Like, it's so irresponsible. You take her back in. And then, like, he's trying to, like, climb down elevator shafts. There's a bit where he, like, opens an elevator shaft, jumps on that cable, and slides down. He doesn't even, like, put a jacket under his hands or anything. Like,
no, it just slides down.
His hands would be shredded. Just shredded like paper. But it's a movie. So we're just doing it. Also, those things are greasy. You know, probably couldn't hang on to it very well.
This is a fantasy picture about giant monsters and UFOs from the ocean's floor.
So you think they'd at least get the elevator right.
Well, I mean, it's important to have, like, real physics when the humans are doing stuff.
Just something that makes it feel, like, vaguely, tangibly connected to any kind of reality that we can recognize. Because that's the thing. It's Godzilla showing up in our reality and how it would respond to Godzilla, right? It's not just He-Man and the Masters of the Universe where everything's fucking weird all the time. It'd be kind of okay if that was it, but that's not it, though. That's not what they're doing.
Yeah.
So, when their hero's doing this weird cartoon action movie shtick, it's kind of distracting. It seems like a pet peeve or a nitpick, but I found it distracting anyway. He manages to, like, get down into, like, the basement, and, like, he's like, "Oh, thank God, my daughter's here in this building that's blowing up. We should go." And so they go. And Godzilla shows up, and they're like, oh no, Godzilla's here. And everyone's like, no, 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 no. He's not here for us. He's here for vengeance. And so he's going to kick that UFO's ass, and the UFO turns into a monster, and it starts turning more into Godzilla, and Godzilla starts fighting it.
And during the fights, this new monster, it's called Orga, I mentioned, yeah. Like, bites Godzilla, or, like, inserts some sort of extraction.
No, he bites him. He bites Godzilla, yeah. And as he's biting Godzilla,
like,
he
becomes more like Godzilla.
Yeah, starts turning green, yeah. And starts growing spikes out of his back. The spikes on this Godzilla, by the way, are absurdly huge.
It's much larger.
Like,
yeah.
they look ridiculously too big. Like, how does he sleep?
They're not as silly as the ridges in Godzilla Minus One, which are retractable.
When he's powering up, out.
They like stick out. I was like, what?
I think that's
just a toy at that point.
I know. I think it's kind of cool, though. That's one where I'm like, I'm willing to let that one go because it's one thing and it's cool. But the whole movie was like that.
I like Godzilla Minus One, but yeah, there's some toyetic moments. It's like,
it's still a Godzilla movie.
What are you doing?
It's still a Godzilla movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it starts turning into this giant monster. It's got these really giant, elongated hands, which are kind of weird. It's asymmetrical.
It has to walk on its knuckles at one point.
And apparently, it can telepathically control the UFO. So, like, when it's fighting Godzilla, when Godzilla has the upper hand, he just sends the UFO flying to smack Godzilla, which is kind of fun. But it's Godzilla's a better fighter. Like, Godzilla's, like, actually, like, kicking his ass a little bit. And then when he starts destroying it, unfortunately, it started to develop Godzilla's regeneration abilities. So if you break it off or break off a piece of it, it just grows back. And Godzilla's like, ah, fuck. What do I do? And that's when Orga does its big finishing move where its mouth opens.
Oh, yeah. And this, like, unhinges and turns into like a python.
Yeah, like a big old python mouth. And it starts swallowing Godzilla whole.
Mm.
Which is admittedly pretty cool. It's a hell of an image.
And it's, we talked about sort of there's some bad CGI effects, especially on the UFOs and the Millennials, but Orga is mostly practical.
Yeah.
And including this weird mouth thing.
Yeah.
They actually, like, built a suit that could swallow a Godzilla suit.
Yeah.
Like, and that took a lot of energy and a lot of forethought.
And it's weird. And a part of me thinks, like, oh, is Godzilla just so shocked by this that he doesn't know what's going on? Because Godzilla isn't fighting it at first. He's just kind of, like, letting himself get sucked in. And then you realize that was Godzilla's plan. This is a tactician Godzilla.
Swallow the top half of my body, and that's what I let loose.
And that's when Godzilla does his radial attack, where he, like, explodes in, like, a nuclear explosion all around him, and just blows Orga all up all at once, so that there's nothing to reconstitute. And that's pretty cool. That's actually one of the better, like, endings to a Godzilla fight I've seen.
Yeah.
And it's certainly memorable. But then something weird happens.
Oh, starting now.
The ending of this movie has kind of stuck with me in a way I really did not expect. It's a very strange ending.
Well, we've talked about how there's, in many of the Godzilla films, there's going to be that little coda where Godzilla's sort of drifting out to sea and somebody will give a really half-hearted speech about I learned about how we have to protect the environment. Or
tampering in God's domain.
He learned too late that man was a feeling creature. You know, that kind of stuff. They do that in this one. They bring back that old tradition.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't make any sense.
No.
This isn't what the movie was about at all.
No, because they start talking about, like, oh, well, science created Godzilla, and then we just immediately started trying to kill him. And I'm like, this wasn't a Frankenstein story. You would need a backstory. You would need a first act to set that up.
You need this, or at least have some kind of dialogue where you sort of get the Takashi, I think Takashi Shimura was dead at this point, but get that type of character, like the old sage who
Someone
had seen it and had been there before.
A voice of authority, and we don't really have that. But then what happens is...
A descendant of Dr. Sarazawa, whoever
that would be fine. But what happens is Godzilla destroys it, and rather than just walking out to sea like he often does at the end of these movies, he turns and he looks at the government guy. And he walks up to him at the top of a building.
And there's that V where he points at his eyes and points at the other guy.
Like, he's staring down this government guy. how does he know who that is? They've never met. He doesn't know that's the guy who's been trying to... How does he know? It's so weird. And the government guy's like, I've never been this close to Godzilla before. And everyone's like, we should go now because this is not good. And he's like, no, leave me. And Godzilla kills him. Very specifically him. Just him. Knew that was the guy.
Godzilla's a smart monster.
Godzilla is a force of karma. And then... after everyone, like, besides that guy escapes, the movie ends with Godzilla just finishing the job in Tokyo. Just destroying everything, and then it says the end. Mm. He doesn't stop and leave, and they even say, like, oh, God, why does Godzilla always save us?
I was gonna say, yeah. That's not how it ends. There's...
No, literally, he's wrecking the joint, and then the movie is over. That's it. He's literally breathing fire on the city. Mm. As the credits come up.
Yeah.
Which is a weird way to end it. It's like, oh, thank God, Godzilla saved us from the UFO. Right, but we're still stuck with Godzilla, and that kind of sucks for us.
It's almost like, oh, we're back.
Yeah.
Like, good. Like, trying to think of, like, some other... let's say that they bring the Klingons back in a Star Trek thing, and they start laying waste to Earth in, like, the last scene of a movie.
Yeah.
And the last scene is, like, Captain Kirk sort of shrugging, well, here we go again, and going after... It's like...
It's sort of like that. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. So we teamed up with Godzilla to fight the UFO, and then once the UFO's destroyed, unfortunately, he's still my enemy. Yeah. We haven't actually, like, gone through, then, like, a life-changing experience.
It cuts to the main guy.
Yeah.
The Godzilla prediction...
Yeah, our hero.
Hero character. He's played by an actor named Takahiro Murata. Mm. And he looks out at the destruction and just sort of sees Godzilla, and kind of wistfully, as Godzilla is doing the destruction, says that Godzilla exists in all of us. Like, he's a part of humanity.
The full exchange is weird, because what he says is, someone says, we scientists produced Godzilla, and ever since, we've tried to destroy him. And then the reporter says, but then why? Why does he keep protecting us? Something he's literally only done this one time, by the way. And again, this is the American dub, so I'm not going to, I'm not going to ding the whole movie on this, but this is the version that exists. And that's when our hero scientist says, maybe because Godzilla is inside each one of us. What the fuck does that even mean? Like, seriously, what are you getting at? Because you've got a few contradictory ideas in there. One is that it's a Frankenstein monster story.
Yeah.
We created Godzilla through science. Kind of hazy on how this Godzilla was made, if it's not the original, but whatever. And now he's destroying us. Okay, whoopsie doodles. Is Godzilla a force of karma for, like, the environment? He's trying to destroy all these power plants and everything. Maybe, but we're not hearkening back to that. And the idea that Godzilla is inside each and every one of us is just nonsense.
Well, like, what is the message that they're trying to give here? That we all have imitators from other countries?
The closest I can...
That we are monsters protecting our own turf, and that, like, we have impulses toward destruction inside of us?
That's the closest thing I can get. That's the closest thing that makes sense to me, is this idea that Godzilla represents sort of humanity's own, almost in a Nietzschean way, urge for self-destruction.
Mm. Freudian way.
No, I thought that was Nietzsche. Didn't Nietzsche talk about, like, the desire to, like, destroy oneself?
That was Freud.
That was Freud? Okay, yeah. Well,
Nietzsche was quite the opposite. He was about strengthening yourself.
I just could have sworn there was, like, one of those, like, look into the abyss type shit. But you know more about that than I do. I totally yield to your knowledge.
I've read some books, that's all.
No, it's fine. It's like you've done more specific research in that than I have, so I'm sure you're right. But yeah, like... what if Godzilla is... humanity is determined to destroy itself until something tries to destroy us, and then we all gang up and we kick its ass, and then we go right back to destroying ourselves. Our sense of self-defense is fucked.
That would have read better if, like, there had been an introductory sequence where somebody was being, like, kind of a scoundrel, or there were two maybe there was like a diplomatic talk that was breaking down, and the countries were fighting each other, and then they banded together to fight Godzilla, like they did in
Gorath.
In Gorath, there you go, the one we saw just recently.
Yeah, it worked.
And then after that happened, after they dispatched with Orga, they went right back to bickering again.
Yeah, that would have been fine.
Like just a little bookend material. Little message. It doesn't take a lot. Take a lot to sort of tell that message.
The most basic rule of screenwriting:
set up and payoff.
It's so simple that the first time you hear it, you might go, "Oh yeah," but like you introduce something early in the movie. And then later in the movie, it comes to fruition in some way. Now, this can be done in very clunky ways. At the beginning of A Long Kiss Goodnight, Gina Davis gives her daughter, like, I was an amnesiac, and I had all I had was this, like, medallion, and I'm going to give it to you, my adopted daughter. Or is it a real daughter?
It's a real daughter.
It's a real daughter. I can't remember how long it had been since she'd, like, had amnesia. But, like, I'm going to give it to you for safekeeping. Okay, I'm going to go off and go on a spy adventure. I wonder if that will be important later. Of course it will.
Yeah.
But it can be more subtle than that. It can be thematic. It can be... That's honestly some of the most satisfying things in film history is when a good setup has an excellent payoff. Like in RoboCop. The ending of RoboCop is such a fucking great setup and payoff because the whole thing is they took his identity.
Uh-huh.
He became a property of a corporation. They said, we own you now. You're no longer Murphy. You're RoboCop. We have erased your memory. And at the end of the movie, when RoboCop kills the bad guy, the old man says, nice work, son. What's your name? And RoboCop says, Murphy. Whole audience explodes every time you see that in the theater. It's awesome. He got his identity back. It's great.
I don't think he got his identity back. I think it was more... He realized that he was a human once.
He was an individual.
Like, he died. Murphy's dead.
True, like technically, yes.
Barely just basic brain functions is all that's left.
No, because like he's remembering stuff. He's got his old personality back somewhere.
Some stuff, a little bit. But I never got the impression that Murphy was back, that he understood who he was or what his past was.
I would argue that RoboCop 2 makes that explicit because he decides not to go back to his wife and like live
as a RoboCop. His wife is a character in RoboCop 2.
Yeah, and more of a character than she is in the original. She's more of like a flashback figure. But I would argue that RoboCop 1, taken in a vacuum as its own film, I think the implication is that he's going to try to rebuild an individual life for himself and not just be a corporate product. I think that's... where that movie is leading. And I think RoboCop, like a lot of sequels to movies that were totally satisfying in and of themselves, you have to kind of undo a bit of the ending in order to keep it going in the way that's satisfying. So I think RoboCop 2 kind of tweaked
that a little bit. I always read RoboCop as he died. Like, Murphy is dead and gone.
He did die.
And they just use his body to sort of build this machine. But there's, like... lingering shreds of human behavior sort of clustered in like whatever cells they were able to scrape up and scoop into that robot suit.
Well, we have different takes on RoboCop. Okay, maybe that wasn't the perfect example. Pretty Woman. She says, towards the beginning of Pretty Woman, she says, one thing I do, I never kiss on the mouth. How does the movie end? She kisses Richard Gere. Perfect. Also, he says he's afraid of heights. What does he do? He climbs a fire escape.
And kisses her on the mouth.
I get both of those setups pay off at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little treacly, but it's satisfying, you know?
So
we don't have that here.
Oh, and you know what? Orga kissed on the mouth as well.
That's right.
Orga. At the beginning it says, I will never swallow a Godzilla, but by the end of the movie...
by God.
Overcomes his fears
and
tries to swallow Godzilla.
But the irony, of course, is that temptation was his self-destruction.
Yeah. Gave in to a baser monster
impulse.
It's
like Mr. Creosote in The Meaning of Life. Just a wafer thin mint. One Godzilla,
you can have one bite of Godzilla. Fine. Glarg, glarg, glarg.
Boom. Godzilla 2000.
Godzilla 2000 is not that good.
No, it's cheap in weird ways. It's really scattershot as storytelling, even as these movies go.
Yeah, I don't like a lot of the American translation. The American general characters is like, we've invented this new missile that's like coated with like special Godzilla slime that can puncture his indestructible skin.
Yeah.
And he actually says something about, like, crap going through a goose.
It'll go through Godzilla like crap through a goose.
Which,
and I'm like,
which I think was also a line from, like, a Michael Bay film at some point. Like, I know I've heard
that.
That
was definitely an American edition I was reading about that. Yeah. That was definitely, like, there was that sentiment was not in the original, apparently. So, all
but I hated
weird.
That kind of cliched, like, army general dialogue.
I guess.
The human characters are just in the wrong place. I don't necessarily need them to be rich and complex, because this is a Godzilla movie. I'm focusing on the monsters.
Mm.
But if you're going to take the time to establish them, make them a little bit more complex than this. Or just have them be background figures to the monster mayhem.
Yeah. Let the monster take more center stage, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
So much of this movie is about these scientists and their history together. And there's whole, like, one scientist says, yeah, why did you leave the department? It's like, it doesn't fucking matter, and you're not going to explain it anyway. It's not coming together. You're implying there's all this drama here, but we're not getting any of it.
I think that's why a lot of audiences are responding to Godzilla Minus One.
It's
one of the only ones that has, like, a really intriguing human story
outside
of the Godzilla drama. That one and Roland Emmerich film, weirdly, have the most, like, actual human stories in them.
I feel like there was, I did kind of like the one...
And maybe the original, but even that like, the humans don't really take center stage until... like the back end of the movie.
No, I think they do, because they're talking about, like, sort of what it takes to stop Godzilla and how far we're willing to fall in terms of our principles.
But I feel like
to do that.
That we don't get to see that through, like, a particular character's eyes until near the end of the movie.
Was it Godzilla versus Gigan that had the Godzilla amusement park?
Yes.
I like the hero of that one.
Oh, it's the cartoonist.
He was the cartoonist, and he had really ridiculous ideas for kaiju monsters, and he was hired by this fake amusement park to, like, keep up their facade.
But they were secretly aliens.
Then he got torn into intrigue, and it was like, all the supporting characters had, like, they weren't complicated, but they had distinct personalities.
Mm.
This was the funny guy, this was, you know, the cartoonist, his girlfriend knew Kung Fu, which was only important once, but by God, it came up.
Mm.
That one was fun. I thought they had fun with the characters, and that was a pretty good balance.
There's also Ebera Horror of the Deep, where they had those guys steal the boat, and they fell in with the criminal.
Oh, yeah, God, that was kind of...
I know it's been a while since we watched that one, but yeah.
But that one's where, like, by the time they get to the island, all that stuff's over. We don't
Once we see the monsters, we don't care about those guys. Like, their arc doesn't matter in that movie.
Anyway.
But yeah, this is all a way of illustrating how poorly the human characters are handled in Godzilla 2000.
Yeah.
They're, like, broad stereotypes, but specific, they're trying to do both at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're not, vague stereotypes.
Yeah, they're not tapping into, like, any kind of sense of, like, late 90s irony where they're, like, commenting on their own shallowness. Nothing like that. Yeah. It's just kind of overall a pretty weak Godzilla movie.
Yeah, it's got highlights. I really do think that opening attack is, I feel like that's where they put a lot of their big effort.
Yeah.
And I think there's bits in the final fight that are really cool. But that's about it, honestly. Not a lot of it stands out, and it's a bit of a bummer. It's not a great start, which may be why, this is just speculation, maybe why they weren't super concerned about keeping it canon. You know? Just going off and doing different shit in the next movie.
There were very few Millennium-era Godzilla movies.
Yeah.
I think there were... 6 in 4 years, like, they just sort of, like, cranked out a bunch.
That's okay. Yeah. You know, but, like, you know, so what happens in the next Godzilla movie?
It's Godzilla versus Mega Geras.
Oh, good. I'm tired of the old Geras. I finally get a good one.
Like, and suddenly it's not like Anguirus. Mega Geras is more like it's sort of more like Mothra. It's like a big bug thing.
Anguirus comes back in Final Wars, though, right?
They all come back in Final Wars. Okay, Every monster comes back in Final Wars.
I just need one more hit off of Anguirus before I die. Like, I just... Come on.
Yeah, let's see. Yeah, Godzilla versus...
Somehow he became one of my favorites. It's like Anguirus and Gigan.
He's the underdog.
Yeah, and... what was that? Manda. Those are my top three favorites.
You're going to like Godzilla Final Wars because we get Chainsaw Gigan.
Yes.
Gigan has two chainsaws on each hand.
Gigan, you are pure chaos, and I love you.
Quadruple chainsaw Gigan.
God, I love Gigan. That's my new sitcom. God, I love Gigan. It's just me and Gigan totally mismatched roommates.
Yeah, Megaguirus is a gigantic mutated Meganulon. Oh. Which is an imaginary creature.
Yeah, well, how does that even help us? Can you give me like a vague description of like what a Meganulon is? Does it look just like another T-Rex?
No, it's like a flying bug creature.
Okay. Yeah, right.
It's like cool. like a giant bug.
Awesome. Glad to hear it. All right, so that's coming up next on Thank Godzilla. It's Friday. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for joining us. Feel free to send us an email if you want. You can want to talk about anything we discussed. If you are familiar, perhaps, with the Japanese version of Godzilla 2000 and want to tell us if we missed anything or if there's some kind of translation thing that makes it work better in the original version, that would be great, honestly, because I was very frustrated that I couldn't find the original version.
Oh, you know what? Yeah. I was just looking up Godzilla versus Megaguirus, a little bit more background. The Meganulon were those bug things from the movie Rodan.
Oh, that's fun. Bugs. So I'm bringing him back.
Megaguirus has mutated one of those.
That's fun.
Haven't seen that thing since the 50s, and now
that's
now
a fun callback. I like that. Okay, so you can do something with that. Anyway, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. If you want to reach out to us, you might read your email on an upcoming episode. We also have a P.O. Box. Whitney, what is that?
Yeah, send us a physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yes. And if you want to listen to future episodes of Thank Godzilla, it's Friday, 1 week early. If you're listening to this on the main feed and you want to listen to Godzilla vs. Megaguirus right now, head on over to patreon.com. All of our patrons get our new shows ad-free, and they get Thank Godzilla, it's Friday, 1 week early. And we also have a lot of other exclusive shows, including our Star Trek podcast, All Our Yesterdays, reviewing every Star Trek ever. We have our Oscars podcast, which we're hoping to do a new episode of very, very soon, where we're reviewing every single film ever nominated for Best Picture.
I'm still working on those. That's on me.
That's a bit labor intensive, but we love doing those, and they're always good deep dives into movie history. So it's one of our favorite things to do. And other things as well. So a huge thank you to all of our patrons. Thank you so much. If you want to support the show, that's the absolute best way to do it. But if you can't, totally understandable. There are other ways to help. Please subscribe if you haven't already. Please leave us a review. That would mean the world to us if we saw some new reviews pop up, because it really jumps us up on the algorithm. When will Godzilla fight an algorithm and kick its ass? That's what I want to know.
Will it be played by John Cheadle?
Yes. Yes. Godzilla's at Warner Brothers right now. Come on.
I'll say this. It wasn't until watching Godzilla 2000 I noticed it's not an error, it's just sort of a weird coincidence about the Godzilla movies.
What's that?
A monster attacks, and it's always about Godzilla's size.
Mm-hmm.
It's never a little monster.
Yeah. Imagine Godzilla wouldn't get involved at that point.
No, but there needs to be, now that we have,
in the army to, like, you know, deal with, like, oh, I have a wasp's nest in my garage. The army is for bigger things.
There should be a Godzilla movie where he has to fight, like 1 million Wolverines or something.
Well, he had Destoroyah.
Destoroyah started out as, like, little bugs.
And eventually separated and attacked him as smaller creatures, and that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, he's typically... Godzilla likes to stay in his weight class, and I think that's respectable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we haven't yet had a Godzilla creature that was... Like, Destoroyah was pretty friggin' huge.
Yeah. Biollante was really huge.
But we haven't had one that's, like... You know, makes Godzilla look like a person.
A
creature that could step on Godzilla.
That would be cool. Godzilla versus Cthulhu.
There you go.
Yeah, that'd be fucking awesome.
I know in Godzilla... I think it's called Planet of the Monsters.
Yeah.
It's the animated film.
We'll get to the animated films. They get
back to Earth after like tens of thousands of years, and Godzilla's just been alive that whole time and continuously growing that entire time. So when they get back, he's literally the size of a mountain.
Yeah.
Like you can't even wrap your mind around that.
Yeah, I know. I love that. I love that sense of scale.
Yeah.
Yeah. It always freaks me out. I used to be, when I was a kid, The most scared I think I've ever been in a movie was when I saw Pinocchio for the first time in the big screen, and Monstro the Whale, when they're like next to him, and they think they're like next to like a big rock, and then his eye opens and it takes up the whole screen and it like zeroes in on Jiminy Cricket. The sense of scale they built with Monstro. Yeah. To this day, when I watch that movie, it kind of freaks me out a little.
What's the name for, there's a name for like fear of very large things.
Yeah.
The phobia.
Like Goliaths and behemoths and they have nightmares about stuff like that. But anyway, that's it. We're on social media. I'm at William Bibbiani. He's at Whitney Seibel. We're at Critic Acclaim. And we'll see you next time on Thank God Till It's Friday. Whitney,
Skrionk.
Skrionk. Thank you. Rar.